If you watch lots of movies, you think the creator of modern-day Las Vegas was Bugsy Siegel or maybe Meyer Lansky. Our guest this hour proposes another name, one perhaps a little less well-known than those other two. The name is Benny Binion, given credit for creating Las Vegas-style poker and leaving a trail of death and injury behind him. Benny was not the nicest guy in the world, it turns out. We learn a whole lot about him in the book Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Vegas gangster who created Vegas poker. Doug J. Swanson is the author of the book. He's an investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He's won awards for his work and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in feature writing. Doug has written five other books, but Blood Aces is his first nonfiction book, and it's now out in paperback. Doug Swanson, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Binion's Horseshoe, I understand, still exists in Las Vegas, and has it been updated over the years like so much of Las Vegas?
Well, yes and no. It's called Binion's, but it's not really part of the Binion family anymore. That's just the name on it. It's changed a lot, but if you walk through it, you can still get a feeling for the old Horseshoe Casino as it was back in its heyday. And that is to say, grimy, not smoky anymore, since they don't have smoking there, but a little down at the heels, needs some paint, needs some new carpet, that sort of thing. But that's always the way the Horseshoe was.
I noticed that unlike a lot of places to this day that refer to gaming and that cute word, Binion's is still listed as a gambling hall.
Yeah, that was always Benny's deal. He started the Horseshoe as a pure gambling joint and kept it that way. If you wanted comedians or bands or magicians or any of that, you went out to the Strip. He always said he didn't want his money running out the end of some guy's trumpet. He ran a pure gambling place.
All right. He really was a one-shot kind of guy. He stuck to that. Nice crispy prose here. You call Benny Binion a Rube Savant. What does that mean?
Well, he didn't have an education. He could barely read or write. He really couldn't do basic multiplication, but he ran this really successful enterprise. He got his education out in the wilds of Texas in the early part of the 20th century with his father, who was a horse trader, and he took Benny out on the road with him when Benny was 9 or 10 years old. He learned how to swindle people that way, and then he fell in with roving bands of gamblers who went out across Texas and would run back alley operations, and that's how he learned to run a gambling situation. But he wasn't even a teenager yet, so that was his Harvard, was out with these roving gamblers in frontier Texas.
Well, that was his graduate school for sure. People do tend to think about Bugsy Siegel largely due to the Warren Beatty film as the quote unquote founder of modern day Las Vegas. But how instrumental would you say Benny was by comparison?
Well, that was a great film, but not much as history. Siegel did have some role, but he wasn't the one and only. Siegel and Binion and others were part of this great wave of mobsters, gangsters, who came to Las Vegas in the late 1940s, and they were the professionals. They knew how to run gambling houses because they had been doing it in places like Dallas and Detroit and Miami and elsewhere. So they started the modern Las Vegas as we now know it. They were the founding fathers, and Binion was right in there with them.
All right, let us not lead anybody astray. I mean, Benny is a fun guy to talk about, pillar of the community in some sense, but how bloody were his hands?
Oh, that depends. I mean, he really was only charged with killing two people. One was a rival bootlegger here in Dallas, and the other was a rival gambling operator. He never served any time for that because he owned the cops and he owned the courts. There were a lot of people, however, through the decades who crossed Benny Binion and wound up dead. He had a pretty competent staff of guys with guns and other weapons, and they took care of business for him. You just didn't cross Benny Binion. That was always the way it was.
In fact, you start the book with an anecdote about some people planning to blow up somebody else in a car. So, yeah, there was lots of people involved in the operation for Benny. The book is full of surprises. Page 7 has a picture of the toddler Benny, just cute as can be. Tell us about his birth family and the circumstances of his early life.
He was born in a place called Pilot Grove, which is in North Texas, a very small town. Most of it burned down when Benny was about 7 years old from a lightning strike. And as I said, his dad took him out on the road. His dad was a drunk and a horse trader, took him out, and he learned the business that way. And then when he was about 16, he went to El Paso, Texas, on the Mexican border, and became a bootlegger. El Paso, during Prohibition, was one of the great smuggling ports in the United States, all sorts of liquor and drugs coming across the Rio Grande from Mexico. Then in the early 1920s, Binion came to Dallas, still as a bootlegger, but soon got into the what was called the policy business here. It was really a numbers lottery. And that's how he got his foot in the door with gambling and started a very successful operation. And he had his business model intact then, and it served him the rest of his life. And that was make some powerful friends, have your powerful friends run the courts and run the police department, and eliminate your enemies. That's the way he did it forever.
It sure worked for him for a long time. You point out in the book that Benny was a sickly kid, and that actually played a part in his father taking him on the road.
Yeah, his dad said he's going to die anyway, so I might as well take him with me. So they rode off together into the wilds of North Texas. I mean, Texas back then, in the early 1900s, with the exception of some of the major cities, was still a very wild place. And he was out with these guys on horseback, roaming from farm town to farm town, looking for people willing to lose money at gambling.
And lose they did, and gain he did. Much more to talk about Benny Binion. He's the title character in the book, Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who created Vegas poker. Doug J. Swanson is the author with us in the Dallas Morning News. We'll come back and talk more with Doug. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Doug Swanson. He is a feature reporter, investigative reporter, rather, for the Dallas Morning News, and the author of several books, including the nonfiction book Blood Aces, about Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who became instrumental in the founding of modern Las Vegas as we know it today. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Blood Aces with Doug Swanson. Phone number here is 800-838-3760. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So give us a little more detail here, Doug. You were talking about what a backwater Texas was in the early 20th century. And so what specifically were some of the places, obviously not schools, where Benny got himself a bit of an education and what became his life?
Well, as I said, he started out in El Paso, which was a great place for smugglers. But when he got to Dallas, he was still very young, very green. He fell in with a man named Warren Diamond, who was the big gambling operator in town, and learned at the foot of Warren Diamond how to run a gambling house. But it was in Dallas that he really came of age, first with this numbers operation. But then in 1936, it was the Texas Centennial. They had a big celebration here in town, in Dallas, a big pageant. And they were losing people, however, to Fort Worth, because Fort Worth, 35 miles to the west, had an exhibit with topless cowgirls. So everyone was going over there and spending their money. The city fathers in Dallas said, what are we going to do? Well, they decided to deregulate gambling, to stop enforcing gambling. And that allowed Benny Binion to really seize control. He started dice games at downtown hotels and, again, eliminating his enemies, owning the authorities, really expanded his operation till he was a first-class racketeer here in town from 1936 to 1946. That's when he really consolidated everything.
Was he much of a gambler himself?
No, he wasn't. He learned very early on that the hot streaks come and go, but it's the house that makes the money. So he would gamble every now and then, play poker every now and then, but Benny's deal was running the organization. That's where the money was. He figured that out very early.
And he reached manhood, apparently, right smack in the middle of the Prohibition years, so that certainly helped with getting involved in that game. There had to be, certainly in El Paso, a few people with badges paying attention. Did he get in much trouble back then?
Oh, he got arrested a few times. He was arrested once in El Paso, apparently. Now, a lot of these records have disappeared because, again, this was back in the early 20th century. Even the records in Dallas have disappeared to a point. So it's hard, in a way, to piece together some of the background. But he was arrested a few times for weapons, things like that, but never served any significant jail time until later in his life when the feds got him for tax evasion. Then he went to prison. But he was never in any big trouble here in Texas because, again, he owned the cops. He owned the courts. He paid them off. He estimated at one point that he was paying about $600,000 a year in bribes. This was back in the 1940s. That was big money then.
It really was. I'm curious about this process you talk about, though, about the records disappearing. I have this sense of you being in musty warehouses looking through old boxes of stuff.
Yeah, I like doing that. That's a lot of fun. And it's, you know, part of my background as a reporter. A lot of the records for Benny that were valuable turned up in FBI files. I got his FBI file, and I got his file from the Bureau of Prisons when he was in Leavenworth. That was very helpful. And ironically, the biggest investigation, or maybe not ironically, but the biggest investigation of organized crime in Dallas didn't come until after the Kennedy assassination, when Congress and the FBI and others were looking for a link between the assassination and organized crime, and they started looking at the gangsters in Dallas, and Benny Binion pops up, not in relation to Kennedy, but as a big-time gangster in Dallas. So a lot of the records turn up there. But if you go looking for the old police records here in town, they're very hard to find.
I can imagine. So the Benny Binion FBI file, is that more like an FBI drawer or two drawers or something?
Oh, it was hundreds and hundreds of pages. There's a lot in there. Now, if you've ever looked at an FBI file, you know that they redact. They black out a lot of material. But what was really interesting with Binion's file was this revelation to me that J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, was very adamant about getting Binion. You can go through his file and see all these handwritten notations by Binion, by Hoover, rather, where he's losing patience with his agents because they're not pursuing Binion aggressively enough. And that really puzzled me. You know, why would J. Edgar Hoover be interested in this guy? And I did some more digging and found that it wasn't just Hoover. It was the Attorney General of the United States at the time. And it went even higher than that. It went to the White House. It went to President Harry Truman, who was giving the Attorney General and Hoover tips on how to pursue Binion. The reason for that was there had been a scandal in the Bureau of Internal Revenue, as it was then called, and Truman and the AG and Hoover were very eager to show that they were now on the case and they were going to put away some big-time criminals for tax problems. So that's why they came after Benny Binion.
Oh, he looked like the low-hanging fruit to guys who really needed to collect some fruit.
Yeah, it's like Al Capone. They didn't get him for killing people. They got him for not paying his taxes.
That does amaze me. So I was drawing the Capone connection myself when I realized I was writing on tax evasion here. The book is called Blood Aces. It's about Benny Binion, the Vegas gambling king. Doug Swanson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Back to Dallas and its history. This is some pretty fascinating stuff you put in here as background. You say it's not fair to say that Dallas was founded by a lunatic gunslinger, but...
Well, yeah, John Neely Bryan, who was the founder of Dallas, who set up a camp and a store on the bluffs over the Trinity River, later went insane and shot a man. So yeah, he had some history that doesn't exactly fit with the modern day image of Dallas. But you know, I think Dallas has this image now of being a conservative, button-down business town, which it is. But back in the day of Benny Binion's reign in the 1930s and 1940s, it was a wild place. I mean, these guys were having shootouts in broad daylight on Main Street downtown. They were trying to blow each other up. They were killing each other left and right. The cops pretty much looked the other way because they were killing each other. They weren't hurting normal citizens. So as long as they were just shooting other criminals, it was pretty much all right.
Oh, so gang wars are okay when it's the gangs killing each other and nobody else is getting caught in the crossfire.
Exactly.
So I'm still intrigued by the way it was hard to catch a guy like Benny Binion for actual murder. At one point, he actually did plead guilty to murder. Why did he get off?
Well, he killed a rival bootlegger who was black, and in the 1930s in Dallas, they did not send away many white men for killing black men, especially if the black man was a criminal. And the other guy he killed was a rival gambler. And that part of it was the nature of the victim. The other part was the district attorney was a close friend of his. The most powerful man in the sheriff's department here in Dallas was a close friend of his. That's just the way Binion operated. He got his arms around his potential adversaries and made them his pals. And that's the way he did it all his life.
To expand the racial angle just a bit, where Benny got off because he killed a black bootlegger, the Klan was big there in the 20s. The Klan was big even in Oregon in the 20s and controlled state government for several years. What was Benny's relationship to the Ku Klux Klan?
He did not embrace the Klan, surprisingly to me, because, I mean, he's a man from a rural background, and you would expect him to be a product of his time and place. But at the time that the Klan was very strong here and had its tentacles into the higher ranges of government, Benny was running his policy operation, his numbers operation, and almost all of the people who bought the numbers chances were black. And so Benny said, I don't believe in hanging my customers. So he stayed away from the Klan. He is still regarded by the descendants of some of the black community here in Dallas as a very benevolent man. Their grandparents worked for Benny Binion, and he treated them right, and they still remember him for that.
Wow, it's amazing. Benny Binion is the topic of discussion here in the book Blood Aces by Doug J. Swanson, an investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about early Vegas and the life of Benny Binion. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Doug, there are lots of quotes in here from Benny himself. Where did you pick those up through the years?
Mostly they came from an oral history interview that he gave the University of Nevada back in the 1970s, and it comes to about 100 pages or so. It was a very long, the longest interview around with Benny. He also gave some interviews to reporters late in life, and I pulled some from that. The problem with Binion and with the family is they had these stories that they built up about him, which maybe were a little bit true, but they grew in the telling, and there were all these legends that that he liked to talk about and the family liked to talk about, and it was very difficult separating the fact from fiction in some of these things.
And I imagine he's still got kids living and grandkids?
He does. He had five children, three of whom survive him, are still alive. One is Jack Binion, who some TV viewers might have seen on commercials for the latter-day versions of the horseshoe around the country. And then he has a daughter, Becky, who lives in the Vegas area, and then a daughter, Brenda, who's a rancher in Amarillo, Texas. Brenda is the only one who would cooperate with me for the book, but she was very helpful. The other family members just didn't want to see it happen for various reasons, but Brenda was great.
What's it like to be the child of Benny Binion? First of all, just from the perspective of how often did she see him? Because it sounds like he was a busy guy, the kind of guy who'd spend most of the day at the office.
Yeah, that's true, but he was a family man. He loved his kids. They loved him. And he was home for dinner almost every night. Now, he may have spent the day plotting to take over gambling joints or ordering someone killed, but he got home in the evening and had dinner with his wife and his kids. He was a very loyal father, and his daughter Brenda still speaks of him with tremendous affection. They all loved horses. He had a ranch in Montana, and the family would go up there and spend the summers up in Montana riding horses and rounding them up, and that was what really pulled the family together. It wasn't the gambling joint, it was the ranch in Montana.
So when Brenda speaks of this affection for her father, she became aware, I have to believe, at some point in her life about a reputation, if not factually understanding what was going on with him.
I think there's a sense that, yeah, he had to do some bad things, but that's just what his line of work required. When I went into this project, what I told Brenda and other friends of Benny to try to persuade them to talk to me was, I'm going to talk about the things he did that many people already know about, the deaths, the crime, all of that. But I want to try to give a full picture of the man. He could be very brutal. He also could be extremely generous. He gave away a lot of money he was, as they say, the best friend you could have and the worst enemy. He did not have an office at the Horseshoe, his casino in Vegas. He just had a table at the restaurant, and just about anybody could walk up and sit down and talk to Benny Binion. If you were a guy off the farm in West Texas and you managed to put together some nickels and make a trip to Las Vegas, Benny would receive you like you were royalty. And people really loved that. And that, I think, is what his friends and family were. That's what they see in him. On one hand, a very expedient businessman and pragmatic to a very violent fault, but at the same time, a really genial, lovable, generous person.
Wow. Back to Benny's heyday in Dallas, 1936 to 1946 or so. I mean, how high did he get in the hierarchy of Dallas Vice?
Oh, he was at the top. He was the king. No one could challenge him. I mean, well, if you did challenge him, you ended up dead. I mean, that was just a fact. There was a man named Herbert Noble who refused to pay his percentage to Binion because Binion controlled all the operations. So Binion ordered him killed. It took Binion's hitmen. They tried 13 times to kill him. They shot him. They blew up his car. He was a pilot. They tried to blow up his airplane, and they missed 13 times. Once they wounded him, and he went to the hospital to recover, and Binion hired a sniper who stood outside the hospital. This is near downtown Dallas, and fired into the hospital with his rifle, trying to kill Herbert Noble. They finally got him on the 14th try with a car bomb.
Wow. In fact, as you point out, the book is illustrated. There's a picture of Mr. Noble, Herbert Noble, driving in his car with bullet holes in the door, just driving like, oh, my car always looks like this. We're talking to Doug Swanson about his book, Blood Aces, about Benny Binion, the Texas guy who made a fortune in Las Vegas as well. And I want to ask about what finally turned the heat on in Dallas, because, this obviously went on for a long time, but something had to change to finally force Benny out of town.
He got complacent, and in 1946, he backed the wrong candidate for sheriff. So another guy won, and he didn't pay attention to the district attorney's race, and the reform candidate won. So his time was up here, and they told him either get out of town or you're going to be killed or arrested. So he loaded up his Cadillac, allegedly with $1 million in cash, and he got two of his best henchmen, and they had Thompson submachine guns, and drove to Las Vegas, and that's in 1946. That's where he got into the casino business there. He got there just in time to attend the opening of the Flamingo Casino out on the Strip, the Bugsy Siegel joint, and that's how he met Bugsy Siegel, whom he really liked.
Okay, so they did know each other.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. He thought Bugsy Siegel was one of the greatest guys he ever met.
What was the general scene in Las Vegas when Benny Binion arrived in 1946? I mean, it's hard to imagine as fast as it grows even today what it looked like 70 years ago.
Yeah, it wasn't much. A dusty little desert town. There were a few casinos along Fremont Street, the main drag in downtown. And there were a couple of places just beginning to develop out on the Strip, which is south of downtown. But it was nothing like you see today. I mean, it wasn't even close. And that's why I say that Binion and the others were the founding fathers of modern Las Vegas. They came in and started these casinos when it really took off. Because in 1946, 1947, there was just not much to it.
There's another name you bring in here that we might not have heard before. That's Guy McAfee. Tell us about the part that he played in developing Las Vegas.
Well, he came from L.A. He was a law enforcement official in L.A., apparently a corrupt law enforcement official. And like many, he was forced to look east and saw in Las Vegas some opportunity and came out and started a place there, a casino out on the Strip. This was really common. The people who would get in trouble elsewhere, they could gravitate to Las Vegas because, A, gambling was legal, and B, if you knew how to run a casino, you were welcome there. And in general, only outlaws knew how to run casinos because they were illegal everywhere else. And, today you can go to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and get a degree in something like gaming studies. Well, they didn't teach that back then. You learned at mob-controlled casinos elsewhere and then came to Las Vegas and started your own operation. And that's just the way it worked.
Well, did you find out how many of the people who graduate from the gaming studies program at UNLV end up getting jobs in casinos?
No, that's a good question. But, you know, it's a very corporate atmosphere now and very respectful. It's part of the business. It's like going into the automotive business in Detroit or Wall Street in New York. It's the landscape. So the taint is gone. I mean, long gone. Now it's quite legitimate. And as I say, it's a corporate environment. The independent operators like Binion are just not around much anymore. I don't think they could survive in today's environment.
Well, especially when you look at guys like Sheldon Adelson, who made all his money in gambling, really getting a lot of presidential candidates to kowtow to him for his money. So
sure.
The times have definitely changed. Much more to talk about with Doug J. Swanson. His book is Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who created Vegas poker. We'll get to some of the specifics about how he did that in the next segment of the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails. Back in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Doug J. Swanson, investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He's won awards for his work, was a Pulitzer finalist in feature writing. He's written 5 books that were fiction, and Blood Aces is his first nonfiction book. It's Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who created Vegas poker, now out in paperback. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Las Vegas as we've come to know it today and its early days in the late 40s with Benny Binion and Bugsy Siegel. And the likes. 800-838-3760, our phone number, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back just for a moment to Dallas because I skipped over this part. I wanted to ask you about the California criminologist who looked at the influence the gambling business held over the Dallas police. And I want to find out what the findings were and what was done with the findings.
Well, they brought in this guy to look at the relationship with the cops and the gamblers and try to figure out how to get things cleaned up. And essentially, he said, look, the situation is hopeless. The gamblers control the police department so well in Dallas that you're never going to be able to reform it. And you might as well set up a different operation, completely separate from the police department to enforce gambling laws. Otherwise, you're never going to do it. And like most studies, the city fathers looked at it and said, oh, that's interesting, and they put it on a shelf where it still sits, by the way, and ignored it because it wasn't in their interest. As I said earlier, Benny Binion and others were paying a tremendous amount of bribes. So if you're in charge and you're getting this bribe money, why would you want to kill that golden calf? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Is there any vestige of that whole operation in Dallas today?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I'd be naive to say there's not gambling going on or there are no bribes being paid. But really, if you want to gamble, why would you do it in Dallas? You can go just about anywhere. You can drive to Shreveport. You can drive for an hour up to Oklahoma at Indian casinos. Or you can hop on a plane and be in Las Vegas in a couple of hours. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So this was back in the day when mobility was much more limited and they just had local guys who wanted to gamble. Now, Binion at one point had an interest in a very luxurious casino outside town called Tapa Hill. And any movie star who came through town who liked to gamble would go out to Tapa Hill, like Buster Keaton, Marlena Dietrich, people like that. Howard Hughes would go out there. Bonnie and Clyde were spotted out there a few times. It was the place to be. So I'm not saying that he just ran grind joints, but, you know, it was a different era then.
Well, and, of course, the things that were illegal in Dallas were legal in Vegas, and so there's obviously a place for Benny to set up shop. What did he do there? How did he get his feet on the ground, and what did he do first?
He came in and bought an interest in a very small casino on Fremont Street, and that played out. After a couple of years, he bought an interest in another one. That didn't work so well. And he was really thinking about leaving town in the late 1940s, early 1950s, maybe just going up to his ranch in Montana. But he bought an interest in an old casino on Fremont called the El Dorado and turned it into the Horseshoe and decided to make it the number one gambling joint in town. And that's what he did.
And it's a pretty, by today's Las Vegas standards, it was really a scrubby-looking kind of joint, like the kind of place you'd expect to see in one of those the frontier towns with the historic districts.
Yeah, I went out and covered the World Series of Poker in the 1980s at the Horseshoe, and the PR people would quietly encourage reporters to stay across the street at the Golden Nugget because it was much nicer. The Horseshoe was pretty grungy. I mean, that was almost a point of pride that, you know, it was just smoky and grimy, and you know, that was just the atmosphere.
Tell us about Benny's role in the creation of the World Series of Poker.
Sure, he started it in 1970. He and his son Jack. What they did was brought in a handful of the world's best poker players, people like Doyle Brunson, Amarillo Slim, and some others, to play poker on the floor of the casino in the Horseshoe, and it was going to be a spectator stunt. And what Binion thought would happen was some people would come in to watch these players, and then after a while they would drift off to the tables at the Horseshoe and lose money at blackjack and dice and roulette and other games. So it was just a stunt, and Benny's biggest hope was that it might someday grow to be 50 or 75 poker players there. Now, as we know, it's thousands of players. This is an international game with millions and millions of prize money, but it started very small in 1970.
So what would you say were the keys to Benny's success? You mentioned he could barely read. You mentioned he wasn't terribly good at math, which is kind of surprising for a guy who accumulated a lot of money. What was the skill set that he brought to his job? I mean, what made him successful?
Well, he could read people very well. He was just a genius at reading people and reading situations. And you talk about the money. The accounting system at the Horseshoe was they would bring the money back to the accounting room and put it in a big pile on the floor. And when that pile got too big, they'd move it. They'd start another one. So I'm not sure he had to bring any accounting skills to the operation. He just knew how to treat people. He always said, treat the little people like big people. And that was the key to his success. He would treat you, if you were a modest appliance salesman from Des Moines, he would treat you the same way he treated the U.S. senators who would come by the Horseshoe, and by that I mean very well. Now, if you were an enemy, you did not get treated very well. You were prone to a violent death. Or if you cheated at the Horseshoe, they didn't call the cops. They'd take you out back, and Binion's security staff would beat you quite severely. But I think his genius was knowing how to assess a situation, how to assess people, and assemble a support staff that was extremely loyal, and eliminate your enemies. That was the key all along.
Benny Binion's the guy we're talking about. He is the subject of Doug Swanson's book, Blood Aces. You skirted just a bit about, just mentioned a bit about mob involvement in gambling, which was a given through the years. What about Benny's relationship to the mob, and whether there was any influence of that in his own organization?
He had a pretty good relationship with them. I at one point called him the Will Rogers of mobsters because he never met one he didn't like. He would always talk about how people like a guy named Ice Pick Willie Alderman was the nicest guy he ever met. Ice Pick Willie got his name by killing people with an ice pick by sticking it in their ears. But to Benny Binion, he was just the greatest guy in the world. He got along with the mobsters pretty well because they left him alone in large part, and he left them alone. He had his own discreet operation. He didn't try to expand, so he wasn't muscling in on someone else's turf. Now, there were some skirmishes. When he first got to Las Vegas, the mob and the local cops helped frame a friend of his for murder. So there were some rough patches, but all in all, they got along pretty well.
Did he ever end up in any sort of financial arrangements with them? Did he pay them any money to stay out of his business, that sort of thing?
What happened was when he went to prison for tax evasion, he went to Leavenworth in the early 1950s, he had to sell off a portion of his casino, a big portion of it, to mobsters. And while he was in prison, they looted the Horseshoe, as they do with many other casinos. They just skimmed cash off the top and took it for themselves. So when he got out of Leavenworth, he had to re-seize control of the Horseshoe through legitimate means. But as I said, there were some rough patches there, but on the whole, I think they respected each other and let each other operate. So there were never any shootouts like there were in Dallas. There weren't the bodies ending up in the desert as a result of mob disputes. Now, there were bodies that ended up in the desert, but I don't think it was because it was a mob fight. It was something much more individual, and perhaps someone who got on Binion's bad side.
Once he was in Las Vegas, I mean, did he still keep some business ties back to Dallas? He certainly kept some personal ties back to Texas.
Yeah, he would sneak back from time to time, and he claimed he didn't control any operations back here at all, but he did. He had, he still had interest back here to a point, and, it was hard to let go. His wife, Teddy Jane, always wanted to move back to Dallas, but he really couldn't come back. If he'd come back, he would have been prosecuted, so, he made his life in Nevada, and obviously did quite well. But he was a Texan. His whole family, they were Texans, so they all wanted to come back.
Was he widely known as the Cowboy?
Well, he got that name. You might think it was because he loved horses, but actually he got it because he shot the rival bootlegger with a quick draw. So that's how he got the nickname. He pulled the gun out really fast when the bootlegger came at him with a knife and shot the bootlegger in the throat. That's when he became known as the Cowboy.
I love the story about an earlier Dallas Morning News reporter who, let me back up a step then and ask it this way, because while he was still in the middle of his heyday in Dallas, there were several newspapers who could have covered this stuff. What kind of coverage did they do on Benny Binion and the whole gambling scene?
Oh, they covered him, and it did not go unnoticed that these guys were killing each other and having these shootouts. But it was accepted as a routine part of life here, which sort of stunned me in a way, that there wasn't more outrage. It was just an acceptable way of doing business here in Dallas. When one gangster would shoot another downtown, there would be big headlines and a big story, but you wouldn't see the follow-up coverage that would try to dig deep into the law enforcement organizations and find out why this was going on, why it was allowed. I mean, I think it was an open secret. Everybody knew what was happening, but the times were such that, remember, this was the Depression. Mm-hmm. Everybody had to make a living, and it was not ignored. It was accepted.
So let me move ahead a few years now to where Benny is in Las Vegas by this point. And an earlier Dallas Morning News reporter goes there to find Benny. And there's a great vignette here about where he meets him and how.
Well, nobody could come to Las Vegas and start looking for Benny without Benny knowing about it. And he would just, as he did with this reporter, walk up to him on the street and say, "Hey, you looking for me?" And then we'd go sit down in the horseshoe and do their business. He was very open with these people to a point. Now, he would never give them anything that could be used against him. I mean, Dallas cops who would be investigating some of the deaths here in Dallas went out to Las Vegas to try to talk to Binion, and he brought him in to his restaurant and sat down and talked to him for a couple hours in a very friendly way, gave them nothing at all in the way of actionable information, then sent them out for a night on the town with one of his bought and paid for law enforcement flunkies there in Las Vegas. They had a great time, came back and wrote this report that said absolutely nothing. Again, that's just the way he controlled people that way.
Wow, he really co-opted a lot of them from the sounds of it. Let's take a call here. We have John and Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Doug Swanson. He's the author of Blood Aces.
I want your comment on a couple of movies. In The Godfather Part II, the Florida gangster, Herman Roth, says that Mo Green invented Las Vegas. I thought that was interesting. I don't know how that got started. I don't know if you've seen that part of the movie. And the other one, though, which is really interesting, it's the movie about blackjack called 21, where these MIT guys, their professor and a bunch of these really smart math guys go and count cards in Vegas. So I guess my real question is, how much cheating is, or how much do they have to watch for that at the casinos? I mean, it seems like gangsters are almost cheating gangsters or something like that. I don't know. But it's just these two movies. Any comment about those two movies if you've seen them before?
All right. Thanks, John.
Sure. Sure. Well, as far as cheating goes, of course, casinos look for cheaters. At the horseshoe, though, I spoke to a man who was not counting cards, but he had a system set up where he was working with another player at the table, and they could spot, because they had a sloppy dealer at the horseshoe, the whole card. So they were working that way and relaying signals to one another. And the people at the horseshoe figured that out pretty fast, took them out back to the security shack where they had an umbrella stand full of canes that had been left behind at the Horseshoe. It was the lost and found for canes. And four or five guys took these canes and beat these two. They weren't cheaters. They were, I guess they were using a system that wasn't allowed. Beat them severely, nearly killed one of them, put him in the hospital for days and days. And these two guys, in an unusual move, sued the Horseshoe and got some money. Also, they got a criminal prosecution of the guys who beat them. Two of them were found guilty. However, the judge threw out the verdict. He didn't think it was just. Now, the judge had been a close to the Binion family for years and years and years, so no one was surprised when he threw out the verdict. But that's just the way it worked in Las Vegas. And, Binion had it wired up left, right, and down the middle.
This is starting to sound like that old Monty Python routine where somebody described a character as he was a cruel man, but fair.
Well, that's true. He was. He was a very fair guy. You just didn't cross him. I mean, it was no secret. You did not cross the Binions in Las Vegas.
And the details of what happened to the people who did are well encapsulated in the book Blood Aces. The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who created Vegas poker. Doug J. Swanson wrote it. It's now out in paperback. Doug, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeff. It was fun.
All right, take care.